The following is lecture number 14. This is the 14th lecture, Thursday, March 16th, 1961. The Ramban points out concerning Lech Lecha that Me'artzecha mimoladetcha mibeis avicha represents a progression of, you see, in Perek, we regard this as one of the nisyonos, one of the 10 trials that Abraham had to endure in order to prove his religious steadfastness. And this is one of them, in the sense that he has to go. He has to leave his whole family and cut himself off from his moorings. So Ramban points out that when God tells him to get out of his country, of his birthplace and his family, it represents successively more difficult ties to sever. To leave a country is easy, to leave any other country. But to leave your own homeland is more difficult. It's a change of language, of mores, of customs. And even that is simpler than leaving your family completely. If you go with your family, at least you take your background with you. But to leave everything is the ultimate test that Abraham had to endure. Rashi points out something very interesting. What is the next sentence? V'yeschol l'goy gadol, I will make you into a great people, great nation. V'avarechecha, I will bless you. V'agadlo shmecha, and I will make your name great. And thus, v'heyei bracha, you will be a blessing. Rashi points out that there is a relationship between the first and second verse. He says that the rabbi said that haderech mima'etes bepiria v'rivya mamon v'shem. If a man is constantly on the move, or people are constantly on the move, families aren't built. There's less piria v'rivya. Families generally aren't built that way. People don't make money. If they're on the move, if they stay at one place and build a business, they get someplace. If you're on the road constantly, at most you can work for somebody else. You can't really build your own fortune. And finally, shame, to make a name for yourself. You make a name for yourself by building something in one place. But if you're constantly on the move, you never have the opportunity to create a reputation. And therefore, God told him, although I'm telling you to get going and to leave the Artzecha, Ma'oladetcha, Beis Avicha, in which case you sacrifice, you think you're going to sacrifice Piria Verivia, which means a family, and mamon, a chance to develop yourself economically, and shame, which means to make a name for yourself, then the point is you have to have confidence that, what are the three blessings? Number one, Ezra l'goy gadol, I make you into a great people. In other words, don't worry about a family, you'll become the father of a great people. Second, don't worry about about money. V'avarechecha, I will bless you. Baracha in general means to increase. The idea of bracha, I mean, etymologically, seems to be connected with the whole concept of increase. That's why in the beginning of Bereishis, if you recall, what is bracha connected with? Pru Revu. Because there it means the increase of, in one case, the human race, in another case, which race? Fish. Fish, even more so, because fish are even more prolific than the animals. So that avaracha here means your wealth will increase, and if you're worried finally about having a name, what is the next thing? V'agadla shmecha, I will make your name great. But the point is that Abraham had to have the confidence that these things will come to pass if he follows the divine command of Lech Lecha. Interesting, how many blessings does Abraham receive here? Can we count them? Eskol gargado. Count. Second is Avarechecha. V'agad l'shmecha is 3. Hayei bracha, 4. Avarech v'avarechem avarechecha is 5. Yes. Mekalelcha a'ar is 6. V'nivrechu v'cha kol mishpachos adama, 7. Why I mention this? Because if you turn to let's pick up the hand. Chapter, say 26, should be in Toldos. Chapter 26, verse 3 and 4, on page 40. This is the blessing that God gives to Yitzchak. Do you have it? Ve'ayemcha, I will be with you as one. Avarechcha, I will bless you. Ki l'chol azarecha eten es kararosas ha'el is, how much? 3. Hakimosis ha'shvur is 4. Herbesi azarecha is 5. Nasata azarecha es kararosas ha'el is 6. V'yaz baruchu bezarecha kol goyei ha'aretz, 7. Look at the last one, incidentally. His baruchu bezarecha kol goyei ha'aretz, all the nations of the world will be blessed through your children, which is identical with the last blessing given to Abraham. V'nivrchu v'chol kol mishpacha sa'adama, all the families of the earth will find blessing through you. This is the universal aspect of the blessing. The blessing isn't given to you that your children should be a great people and lord it over others, but rather that you will become a source of blessing for the rest of mankind. Now, if you look at so also 7 blessings. If you look at chapter 27 now, the end of the chapter, let's not end. V'divitan lecha, page 43, verse 28. This is the blessing now that Yitzchak gives to his son, to Yaakov. And what do you have? V'yitem lecha alehim itala shemayim eshmane yores is 1, the whole sentence. Then you have ducha amim 2, yishtachavu is 3, have a gvir is 4, yishtachavu is 5, v'orecha orer is 6, m'vorecha baruch 7. In each case you have the round number of 7.
We had that before.
In Brachos.
What's round about 7?
It is round. You see, in our mathematical system it's a prime number, it's very unround. In fact, it's one of the unroundest number there is. But by round, I mean it's the number which indicates fullness. Fullness, like 7 days of the week. Or Shivosayim Yukam Kayan. Or Shivim Vesheva, 77. All multiples of 7 have the impact, the intonation, the implication of fullness. So the bracha that Abraham receives from God is full, it's 7. In turn, he gives it to his son to his son, all of them in units of 7. And this really ties the brachas all together. It makes them one unit, even mathematically. The v'nivrchu v'cha, of course, as I pointed out in the beginning, is the universalist element. The idea that the brachos were meant, as I pointed out again last week, that in the time of Abraham, God had started the world twice. The universalist experiment, and giving it to all mankind equally. When mankind failed, God chose one family, but Noah and the Dor HaFloga, the Tower of Babel. Then the third time, God took Abraham and gave it to him alone, so that through him, he would build a teacher people who would then teach the rest of the world, and as a result, the rest of the world would find redemption in the sense of rising to a higher level. Now, there's something I wanted to point out about Abraham's character. And it ties into another part of the Tanakh. Abraham, at the beginning of the Sedra, or the end of the last Sedra, the end of Noach, do you notice who is the brother of Abraham? Nacharon. Let's say 11:31. Chapter 11, verse 31. Haran. Yes? And Terach took his son Abraham and Lot the son of Haran, and they went further. Haran, you also have in verse 28 at the end of Noach. 11:28. Or 11:27. And these are the children of Terach. Terach bore Abraham and Nachor and Haran. And Haran bore Lot. And Haran died during the lifetime of his father Terach. So that the relationship of Abraham to Lot is that Abraham's brother is Haran and Haran's son is Lot. You notice that Abraham's character throughout is the character of implicit, immediate obedience to the Ribbono Shel Olam. You don't notice one ounce of hesitation on his part. The only place you notice hesitation of any kind is when it comes to pleading for somebody else, for Saddam, where he's very unanxious to allow the gzerah, the divine decree, to take effect without any kind of interference. But when God tells him lech lecha, we don't find any hesitation. He's going. God tells him the Akedah, so he will try to narrow down, does he really mean Yitzchak? But once he knows that it means Yitzchak, he goes ahead. In other words, there's no hesitation. There's an immediate commitment to the divine command, an immediate response. That's why we say in our davening, quoting the Divrei Hayamim, concerning Avraham, that Umatzasa es levavo ne'aman lefanecha. That you found, with speaking to God, we say you found his heart trustworthy. Because immediately his heart was of such a nature that he immediately responded. Tell me, the Mashiach to come in the future, whom will he be descended from? David. Yes? It'll be some part of the Jewish thought has always seen the Mashiach as Ben David. Mashiach Ben David. Whom is David descended from?
How far do you want
to
go?
Go four generations.
Naomi.
No.
Boaz and Boaz.
Boaz and
Ruth.
And Ruth. Yes? Boaz and Ruth are the fourth generation before. Do you ever figure out why? Who has to have a whole story of Ruth? What is the significance of it? It's one of the mysteries. On Shavuos, we read the story of Ruth. And the whole story of Ruth is it's a fabulous story, of course. It's the beautiful pastoral spirit. But since when are we poets? I mean, if we want, we can read Shelley and Keats and Shul too. I mean, why do we read the Ruth? There's a reason for it, of course. Ruth concludes with the genealogy of David. That Ruth and Boaz had Oved, who had someone else, who had Yishai, who had David. So that the whole point of Ruth, obviously, is to show the genealogy of the king of Israel, who represents to us as well the hope for the future. Now take Boaz and Ruth. Where are they descended from? I want to show you how the whole idea of David, therefore the ideal Jewish king, or the ideal Jew, as well as Mashiach, the ideal Jew, I want to trace typologically the character they had, the character types that are supposed to be merged within the ideal Jew. And this is the story of Ruth, basically. Whom does Boaz come from? In order to find out who Boaz is, what kind of person he is. Whom is Boaz? Who is the first ancestor of Boaz, before, other than Adam? Abraham. He's a Jew. Yes? Boaz comes from Avraham. How about Ruth? Where does she come from? She's a Moabite. Yes? Moabite. Who was Moab descended from? Moab began as one individual. Anyone? Lot. Remember when Lot committed incest with his daughter? Who was born there from? Moab and Ammon. So that Ruth comes from Moab, who comes from Lot, and who does Lot come from? Haran. So that Ruth and Boaz, being Jews and Moabites, are descended from two brothers. Haran and Abraham. Now let's try to find out something about Haran and Abraham to see what qualities they had which differed, and how Ruth was able to recapture the proper spirit, and therefore with Boaz to represent two lines of characterological development in this ideal Jew. The line of Boaz through Abraham represents the idea of immediate loyalty, right? Immediate loyalty to the Rabbanei Shalom. Matzosa es levavo ne'amo lefanecha. How about this fellow Haran who died young? Whom did he represent? What does he represent, rather? The Medrash is intrigued, the oral tradition is intrigued by the death of Haran young, and they want to know what happened. And they describe it in a very interesting fashion. They tell us that Haran, when Nimrod decided to toss Abraham into the Kivshon Shalesh, into the furnace, and to kill him because of his rebelliousness against idolatry and therefore against Nimrod, who declared himself a god and had people bowing down to his image. So Abraham, you know, was willing to be cast into the furnace because he refused to accept the idol. What was Haran doing meanwhile? The rabbis tell us, or the Medrash tells us, that Haran was standing on the sidelines in this battle between Abraham and Nimrod, which had all kinds of connotations, political and religious. Actually, the one act of rebellion against Nimrod for religious purposes had political consequences. Because if you deny that Nimrod was a god, it means you were a rebel. The same as Mordechai's refusal to bow to Haman was interpreted as having political consequences. Haran, the brother of Abraham, was standing on the sidelines and said simply this. He said, I'm going to see what's going to happen. Im Avraham notzeach, mishelo anochi. V'im Nimrod notzeach, mishelo anochi. If Abraham wins, I'm Abraham's man. If Nimrod wins, I'm Nimrod's man. This was his attitude. Positive neutrality. See? He's positively neutral. Whoever's going to win, he's going to be on his side. A perfectly opportunistic idea. Simply, not because he was necessarily a bad chap, but he couldn't make up his mind. There was an element of indecisiveness, just the reverse of Abraham's immediate decisiveness on the side of the Ribbono Shel Olam. What happened, of course, is a separate story. What happened was he saw that Abraham came out alive of the furnace. So he said, well, Abraham, so I'm on his side. Nimrod said, you're on his side, we'll toss you into the furnace too. And they did. And Vayomos Haron al Pnei Terechav, he died. Because he did not deserve. He had not shown any loyalty. His was simply an opportunistic choice of Abraham. Now what about Abraham's son, Haran's son Lot? Do you notice any greatness in Lot? No. Lot ultimately turns out to go with Abraham. But is he decisive? Absolutely not. The whole character of Lot is one of weakness. If you read through the Lech Lecha and Vayera, do it on your own sometimes, and try to trace simply from what you have in the Chumash, try to trace the character of Lot, you'll notice a typically weak character. He's a man who can't make up his mind, a man who doesn't know where he's going. He can't choose between Abraham and Sodom. He can't make up his mind. At the last moment, he does choose, but he's pulled out of Lot by the scruff of his neck, pulled out by the Malachim. And finally, he doesn't know where to go, and his wife actually does want to turn back. In other words, the whole development of Lot is one of weakness. His daughters get him drunk and they lead him astray. There's no strength of character. It's indecisiveness. Go a step further. What about Lot's descendant Moab? You know, it's a remarkable thing. Can an Egyptian become a Jew? A geir, can you marry him? Yes. Amalek. Amalek was terrible. But if an Amalekite had become Jewish, had become a geir, can a Jew marry an Amalekite? Certainly. How about an Ammonite or a Moabite? Even if they convert, they were not accepted for 10 generations. Of course, they don't exist today anymore, so today is no longer any difference. But a Moabite not. Why were the Moabites treated so harshly? Why were they so strong against them? Do you remember what happened with Moab? What does the Torah say why we can't marry Moabites? Al dvar asher lo kidmu eschem balechem uvamayim. Because when Israel was going through the desert, Moab did not come forth to offer at least bread and water for the passing people, women and children, and allow them to refresh and go on further. Now, is that a sufficient reason? Compare Moab's sin to Amalek's sin. Who was worse? Amalek. Amalek destroyed. Compare them to the Egyptians. Were the Egyptians better to us? I mean, with all the trouble they gave us? Excuse me. Yet an Egyptian where we must accept? An Egyptian, the prophets say they're your brothers? Amalek, with all our anger against Amalek, we didn't give him this kind of barrier before them? So Amoav, we didn't allow them to come in. Again, you see, why were we so severe against Amalek, against Moab? Because Amalek, at least, was a savage tribe. They saw Jews, they hated Jews, they went to attack. But they did it. Later, if they became a Jew, if one of them became a Jew, he's Jewish. That means he made a decision for Jewishness. The Mitzrim were for or against, but they were decisive. You knew where they were going. And if they did something cruel, at least it was done in the heat or the rage of cruelty. You know, passionate, temperamental people, finished. Moab didn't do anything positively bad. But they simply couldn't make up their minds, so meanwhile people passed and died. They didn't come forth with bread and wood, they didn't take anything away, but they couldn't make up their mind to attack or not to attack. Meanwhile, you passed by and nothing happened when they had the opportunity. There was an element again of indecisiveness in the background of Moab, which repeats the indecisiveness of Lot, which repeats the indecisiveness of Haran. So that the whole line of development of this brother was one of complete indecision, whereas the development of Avraham was generally one of a decisive commitment. When you come to Ruth, what you have is a very wonderful thing. Ruth the Moabite shows that she can be decisive. There is a moment of hesitation. There is a moment of trying to understand what's going on. But once a decision is made, do you remember the famous words of her decision? Pasha, wherever you sleep, I shall sleep. Your God is my God. Your people is my people. Well, this is commitment. This is the flower of expression of the idea of commitment. There is no more beautiful expression in all the world's literature of what commitment really means. in the simple human terms. So that Ruth does commit herself. She is Goel, she redeems the whole character of Haran, Lot, and Moab. And she shows that she is able to add something to the Jewish bloodstream. To this immediate temperamental decisiveness, which is a wonderful quality, she adds the moment of pondering, of meditation. And then, instead of allowing herself to drift off into a paralysis of thought, she knows how to commit herself. So that the union of Boaz and Ruth represents, typologically, the union of a perfect character, of a powerful commitment, followed by a moment of wondering, and then going ahead. And this is really the basic quality of David. Quality of standing still for a moment, and then coming to a decision. Which is basically a very important characterological point. Because there are people, you know the famous story of the man who came to a psychiatrist, don't you? With the oranges, you don't know? Man who came to a psychiatrist and he says, "Doctor, I'm in serious trouble." He says, What's the problem? He says, it's my business. What do you do? He says, "Oranges, I'm an orange sorter. My job is to take the oranges and put them, large ones into one crate, the medium size into another crate, small into another crate." "So what's the problem?" He says, "I can't stand it." He says, "Decisions, decisions, decisions. All day long is decisions." I mean, there are people who are naturally hesitant to commit themselves. They can't decide, you know. And what happens? You spend a lifetime not deciding. Of course, religion is a big thing that you can't decide at least for 30 or 40 or 50 years. But even small things they can't do. There are people who do it too fast. The ideal of David is to have the quality of Boaz and Ruth mixed, which means, basically, Abraham and Haran, both qualities. So that in David you find a combination of the best of Avram and the best of Haran, the best of both qualities.
It's interesting, halakhically, how is she committed to being, aside from this pettiness of being a woman, I don't understand.
Not pettiness, it's a, that was the halakha says Ammoni and Moavi.
Yeah.
And this was the Mischatcha halakha. That it was only the male Moabites and Ammonites who were forbidden. Well, no, I'm trying to represent it in a supra halachic way, but obviously they did it for her too. The halacha had been forgotten until Ruth. The halacha never came up. In other words, the problem never came up until Ruth. Ruth was the Moabite, the first Moabite who wanted to become Jewish.
Yeah, but then what would be the reason? In other words, you ascribe a reason of hesitancy.
No, you see, in giving any reasons for things of this sort, it's like an all of law. The ratio legis, the reason for the law, is never the determinant for the law, but it's the perfect explanation for the law. So that the halacha is independent. My reason is an ascription, which explains it. But people don't make a law because of... You see, the rabbis didn't sit down and say, or the halacha didn't sit down and say, well, there's a character streak going through, therefore we will make the law. That may have informed the halacha to begin with, but it isn't the thing you decide on that basis alone. You follow what I mean?
Very exciting.
I can say that the law of not to wear semeru pishtim yachtav, not to wear linen and wool mikshatnas, I can say that the reason for that law, basically, I see in that is because it represents the combination of Kayin and Hevel. There are lots of people who give that reason. The tzemer, the wool, represents Abel, and the other one, the cotton, the linen rather, represents the farmer, the agriculturist, or Cain. And we don't combine the two of them because one was a detestable character, one was a good character. There are those who give this reason, as an example. Now, does it mean that I can take shatnez and wear it and say, before I put on my jacket of shatnez, hinani muchana mezuman, I want to say clearly that I have no intention of mixing the qualities of Cain and Abel in my mind. Can I do that? No. The law is the law, regardless of the reason that may have motivated it. Because by nature, that's what law means, otherwise it isn't law. You see?
In other words, you're telling me it is a reason for it, but it isn't.
No. It is a reason. But a reason for any law cannot be used as a determinant in operating with the law. give you an example. Why can't you cross a red light?
Unless you're hit by a car.
All right. Now, what happens if I go to the corner of 86 and Columbus, 4 in the morning, and I look? There's not a car in a mile from me. I can see clearly all sides. Well, I decide the reason for the law is I shouldn't be hit by a car. There's no car. I'm going to go ahead. Policeman gives me a ticket, and I come to the court, and I tell the judge my argument. Do I get a ticket or not? I get fined double as much, because who am I to go around interpreting the law myself? But it's true. Is it true that the law was made for that reason?
Well, you gave, I remember the previous class, you gave a reason for the, something to do with disbanding certain law, because the something about killing, criminal punishment, you said that being that the reason wasn't active then,
Well, yeah, but then, very true. The reason wasn't being fulfilled. But there, they did not violate the law, but there they made the condition such that the law is no longer applicable. In other words, where?
Yeah.
No, you see, but when it comes to a thing of this sort, now I give this reason. This is the way I understand the story of Ruth, and the way I trace it back to our Sedra. How do you know that I'm right? Sounds good. I think there's a great deal of truth to it. But I may be all off. Torah hivalumo danitzara. Perhaps next week we'll meet again and I'll say, you know, I thought of a better idea. That the reason for the story of Ruth isn't at all because of this, is to prove that that barley is better than wheat. I have an agricultural reason. And I'll convince you about it. You see, but then you can almost, then you'll be able to see that, look, there are many ways of seeing one event. And somehow, in life, there is no monolith. Nothing is done for one reason. It's a convergence of reasons. It's like two poles of a magnet when you have the iron filings around it. There are a lot of lines of force. This is one way of looking at it. But the reason for the halacha, maybe that was not this alone.
But you're saying there is a reason.
Of course, everything has a reason. I agree with Rambam. Everything has a reason. We don't always know the right one. I'm trying to discover it. But when I try to discover, I am trying to discover. And I'm not the one who made the law, therefore I can't always be 1,000% sure, unless the Torah tells me why it is. Anyway, so that, to my mind, this represents the meaning of Avram and Haran down to through to King David. Now, if we go further, just a bit further in Lech Lecha, Abraham is no longer a young man when he leaves, is he? How old is he? 75 years. He's just about ready for his... Just about ready. He's already retired. If he'd been living in our society, he's ready to settle down. Be'artzecha, uve'moladetcha, uve'veisavicha. And what happens? God tells him to pick himself up and start a career. And he does. He leaves. And what does he do in verse 5? He takes with himself Sarai, his wife, Lot, his nephew, all their property, and what else? What is the Hebrew there? V'es ha-nefesh asher osu v'charan. How does the English translate that? The persons he obtained in Charan. What does that mean? If you follow Pshat, there are those who say the slaves. But somehow the rabbis were never satisfied with that. But to say that they were the slaves alone is an unsatisfactory response. The rabbis had another interpretation which is dominant in all of the rabbinic understanding of Chumash. And what is that?
It's converts.
The converts. In other words, Abraham was not only a man who had discovered God, but he's a man who preached. Because when you are seized with the knowledge of the Rabbana Shalom, then you can't be satisfied merely with retaining it in an abstract fashion. But you've got to, it's got to grab hold of you and transform your life, and you've got to have the urge to tell it to others too. Abraham becomes a missionary, and he begins to teach people the vanity of idolatry, and to teach them the value of belief in one God. Avraham megayer anashim, v'Sarah megayer es nashim. Abraham converted the men, Sarah converted the woman. It's very interesting that this this verse plays such a key role at one time in Jewish history, in Jewish life. Do you know, in Babylon, Babylon was probably one of the most fertile centers of Jewish life and thought. From the days of Rav, when did Rav live? No, Jared, when did he live? About, Rebbe lived in the year, no, 212. The year 212, Rav came to Babel. 212 of the Common Era, Abba Aricha came to Babylon from Jerusalem, and he opened up the first school. From that time until Rav Haigon, which means the 11th century, 3rd to 11th century, for 800 years, Babylon was the major center of Jewish life and thought. What was produced in this time in Babylon? The Talmud. And what else? The Gaonic period. The richest period, one of the richest periods of Jewish life for 800 years. Now, a tremendous system of adult education had developed during this time. During the week, the scholars would receive their lectures in the yeshiva. On Shabbos, the ordinary laity would gather in the synagogues, and one of the scholars, generally the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, would give a lecture called a pirka. The pirka was a lecture given to a combination of the balabatim and the advanced students of the yeshiva. Interesting that the advanced students of the yeshiva used to sit in the back because they were somewhat bored by a lecture which was popular enough to be understood by the laymen. Understandable, but the teachers never allowed them to leave. They always insisted that they stay and attend the lecture anyway. Although they were professionals, they were beyond this, but they had to attend and mingle with the people. They couldn't set themselves off completely. So Shabbos, the pirka was given by the chief of the yeshiva, or anyone he assigned, as the sermon. It was more than a sermon, it was also teaching. This was the system at that time. When it came to one particular Shabbos, a holiday was made. You see, in those days, the Jewish community of Babylon was autonomous. It ran by itself. And there were two heads of jury, of Babylonian jury. The Rosh Yeshiva, who was, what was he called in those days, you know? The Gaon. He was the religious and intellectual head. And there was a political head called the Reish Galusa. What does Reish Galusa mean? The head of the exile, or how do we call it in English now? Exilarch. Exilarch, the head of the exile. The exilarch was also not an Am Haaretz, generally. He was an educated man. On Shabbos Lech Lecha, every Shabbos Lech Lecha, it was not the Gaon who gave the Pirka, the public lecture on Shabbos, but Shabbos Lech Lecha was called Rigla de Reish Galusa. The holiday of the Reish Galusa, of the exilarch. It was the president's day, so to speak. And he himself gave the drasha on that day, the pirka. Do you know why? Interesting story. Because the Tana de Be'aliyo, one of the earliest Mishnaic works, represents what you can call a Jewish historiography, a Jewish analysis of history. And this analysis of history is that the world, 6,000 years, and our current historical span is taken as being a 6,000-year span, consists of three periods of approximate equality, each period lasting 2,000 years. And they are divided as follows. The first 2,000 years are called Tohu. The second are called Torah. And the third is called Mashiach. Tohu means what?
Turmoil.
Turmoil or chaos. Torah, you know, Mashiach, you know. What does it mean? It means that the world was created. When the world was created, what was the world? At the very first moment of creation. Tohu Vavohu was chaotic. Null and void. Chaotic and void. So chaos means the period when the world, when the world is still in a period of a process of formation and is incomplete. And the incompleteness of 2,000 years refers not to physical incompleteness as much as spiritual incompleteness. In other words, the world still was stumbling in a blind alley. What happened at the end of 2,000 years? Torah was given. God somehow was involved with man. God engaged man, if you want to use a fancy word, in a dialogue. he began to have relations with mankind again. And he revealed to man a way of life. Now this period continued for 2,000 years too. At the end of those 2,000 years, Torah was finally achieved. And what began? The period of Mashiach. What does that mean? That Mashiach came? No. What then? Yes. How do they prepare for Mashiach? Mashiach represents the battle between Torah and Tohu. The forces of Tohu, which means before the Torah came, the forces of paganism, of evil, of spiritual chaos and confusion, battling against the forces that want to crystallize the human spirit, crystallize the divine in man, or the forces of Torah. These two are locked in a struggle, and this is the meaning of Mashiach. When the struggle will finally come to a conclusion with the victory of Torah, then Mashiach will come, and the 2,000 year period is culminated in the victory of Torah. So that, I'll tell you how this comes to the Dishkalus in a minute. So that the first period is Tohu. When the Word of God comes, the period of Torah starts. When Torah is disseminated amongst all people, the period of Torah has concluded and the period of Mashiach begins. Now, when does Tohu begin? At the moment of creation. When does the third period end, Mashiach? With Mashiach, or the redemption of the entire world. The question is the two intermediate points. In other words, what is the transition point of Torah, of Tohu to Torah, and what is the transition point of Torah to Mashiach? According to the Talmud de Be'el Iyot, to this book, the two transition points are as follows. This is interesting historically. The transition from Torah to Tohu comes with the words Hanefesh Asher Asa Bacharam. When Abraham decides that he has to take this revelation, and this is a Derech Chayim, a way of life that God had revealed to him, and let it be known to all people. And spread the word, to teach it to all mankind. That is the moment that Torah begins, much before Moses. This represents the first transition. And when does this period end with Torah? With the foundation of the Yeshivas of Bavel. When Rav, or Abba Aricha, comes from Palestine in the year 212 to open up the Great Academy of Babylon and to begin this great period of history and the dissemination of Torah Sheba Al Peh, of the Oral Law, that is the climax of the point of Torah and the period of Mashiach begins. Now, the foundation of the period of Bavel is represented in the Yeshivas. It begins with Lech Lecha. Therefore, on the Parsha of Lech Lecha, the Sedra of Lech Lecha, when you read about Abraham beginning the period of Torah, the Resh Galusa, the head of the exile, representing Babylonian Jewry, which was begun as the culmination of the point of Torah, is his Shabbos. So both periods are combined in an annual drasha given by the Resh Galusa on the Shabbos of Lech Lecha.
Doesn't that imply, though, that the importance of Israel has been negated in the land of Israel? If the Mashiach period must be ushered in with the Jews going out to the Galut,
would
that?
Well, don't forget, first, two things. First, you're right. Second, you're not completely right. You're right in the sense that Israel, or the land of Israel, plays a very important place in Jewish life. But it doesn't play that role that, let's say, Ibn Gurion assigns to it. When Ibn Gurion, he takes an extreme position. He takes a position that, to my mind, is absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's the kind of extremeness that one expects either in very young people or very old people. No, really, it's an extreme position. His position is that all of Jewish history, from the time the Jews left Palestine until 1948, is absolutely null and void. In fact, the only thing that lit up to any extent Jewish history during 2,000 years was Spinoza. Well, this is his point of view. It's utterly ridiculous. I mean, it's negating the greatest fruit that we gave.
From his point of view,
all right, I'm coming to this. So, what is the other extreme? To say that the Palestine means nothing, it's ridiculous. It does mean something. Obviously, it means so much to us. It means very much to us. I mean, Eretz Israel is one of the greatest messages. But the Torah was given to us before we came to Palestine. And Mashiach represents the return to Palestine. But he's going to come to people in Galus. And the coming of Mashiach, according to Jewish traditional thought, although this never was clearly delineated, is to be preceded by a period of great conflict and chaos in the world. Melchemes Gog and Magog and so on. which means essentially that Mashiach will be the culmination of a struggle between the forces of good and evil. Although in actual practice no one is altogether good and no one is altogether evil, but essentially it means that there will be that there will be locked in conflict, and that the good will triumph over the evil. Now that doesn't really relate to decentralizing Palestine by any means.
Oh, it would seem to imply that the Jews would have to leave Palestine. Whereas,
why?
To disseminate information in Torah. Obviously you couldn't go.
Well, no, you mean because Rav came to Bavel? Well, no, but you know that the rabbis were rather firm on that point. There were two opinions. One opinion was that Eretz Yisrael retains its supremacy at all times. The opinion of Rav Yehuda was that whoever goes from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael commits a sin. Because in those days Eretz Yisrael was absolutely nothing. I mean, culturally and religiously, spiritually. And Bavel was a great spiritual center. What do you mean?
The importance of Israel
playing a role. Yeah, relative importance. That it was important, everyone agrees, but against Bavel, it was not important. One opinion. It's not necessarily the opinion. But there were opinions about this. In other words, what comes first? The geographic problem of Kedusha? Or the fact of real life? And there were those who maintained that to go from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael means to go from a highly developed religious society into something which is primitive. And they said no. Others said you must anyway. I mean, it still retains a higher level of significance for us. But anyway, further. Let's go to Abraham and Lot. So that Vayikach Avraham on 12, verse 5, Vayikach Avraham es Sarai Ishto. He takes his wife Sarah and Lot, his nephew, and their property, and the people they made, whatever that means, as we try to explain it, and they went to Canaan, and they came to Canaan. And Avraham passed through the land until Shechem, until Elo Mamre, and the Canaanite was then in the land. Now, turn to chapter 13, verse 1. And Abraham left Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had. And Lot was with him on the way southwards. Now verse 7. And there was a battle between the shepherds of Abraham and the shepherds of Lot. I'm translating freely so it may differ from yours. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite were then dwelt in the land. Now there's a similarity between both of these expressions, isn't there? Chapter 12, verse 5 says, and Abraham took... Well, what is the difference between 5 and 1? Chapter 12, 5 and 13, 1. Do you notice a subtle distinction there? What do you see? In chapter 12, verse 5, Lot is part of Abraham's family. He's part of Abraham's family. He's part of Abraham's tribe, part of his life, part of his influence. He's with him. In chapter 13, verse 1, what happens? He's going along with him, but he's no longer part of his family. Because in verse 1 in the next chapter, Abraham goes up, his wife and all that he has, period, or semicolon, and Lot also goes with him. He's a me too. But he's only traveling with him. But spiritually, he's already left him. The Torah is preparing us by subtle word order for the fact that Lot is yet to leave completely. Before, the Torah pointed out carefully that the Canaanite lived in the land, and in chapter 13, verse 7, when the battle erupts between the shepherds of Lot and the shepherds of Abraham, which is just about the point that causes them to separate completely, what happens? What does the Torah point out? Cryptic words. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite were then in the land. Who's interested? What has this got to do with the narrative? Here the Torah wants to tell us a story of how Lot leaves Abraham, and suddenly we're told that the Canaanite and Perizzite were then dwelling in the land. So what? Well, the fact that they dwelt there, you're coming to the point, yes. You're just about at the point. It was a very good insight. The point is that the question is, who needs to know that the Canaanite and Perizzite were there? Because the Torah is not telling us the story of the development of the races. It's not a book of ethnology. The answer is this. It would seem from the story, will someone read chapters 5 to 13, verse 5 to 13 in chapter 13? Shlishi, what happens? Read verse 5, somebody. And Lot also, who went with Abraham, had sheep and cattle and what it was, how does he translate all them? Tents. And the land wasn't big enough to carry them both because their property or their whatever they had was too much and they couldn't dwell together. So there was a battle between the shepherds of Abraham and those of Lot. The Canaanite and priest that were then on the land. So Abraham, being the gentleman, turns to Lot and says, look, why do we have to battle? You go your way, I'll go my way. Wherever you go, you choose. I'll go the other way. You go right, I'll go left, and vice versa. So Lot decides that he's going to take the better part, and he goes to Sodom, yes? And he marches his way. It would seem that, what was the reason for the battle? What was the problem? Why did this breakup of the tribe or the clan or the family occur? One word. No?
Jealousy.
What kind of jealousy?
Was there religious jealousy?
Well, that's going to. But what would it seem from the pshat? What kind of problem did they have?
They seemed to have enough property.
Yes, but what was the problem? They didn't have enough. They had enough property, but there wasn't enough grazing land. Right? The land wasn't big enough to hold the. So the problem, therefore, was primarily economical. In other words, I haven't got place for my animals to grow, you haven't got place for yours, therefore it's one of us has to go. So it would seem that the pasture problem, as you say, they had too many flocks for the land that was before them. Therefore, it was an economic problem that caused them to leave each other. Again, all right, this is good enough if you accept it as it is, but why those words, Aknani, Naprizi, Az, Yoshi, Baris?
Well,
yes.
Actually, we go back to your old interpretation that Abraham was out to convert people.
Yeah.
The mission of God and the strife between him and Lot might hinder his operations in this field.
Perhaps.
Depending on which way you wish that might be in public.
No. That's why Abraham was willing to let him go.
Yeah.
But why did Lot? What originally was the force, the reason for the conflict? So it seems to be economical. Then the question is, what are the words Vaknani Vaprizi Az Yoshe Baretz? So Ramban, who accepts the economic interpretation of history, we're making a Marxist out of the Ramban. So Ramban, who accepts this interpretation, simply says this, that Abraham was afraid of inciting any battle between them. He'll incite all the others to get into the fray. And he did not want to incite the animosity of the local tribes. He says, look, better you go your way wherever you choose and I'll go someplace else. Because in case we continue in one area amongst these people and they see us arguing, they're going to jump into the fray and try to get whatever they can. Well, that's that, but actually I think Rashi comes closer to the truth when he quotes the Chazal, the rabbis, who say that the problem was simply behemos yotzos zemumos. Abraham, when he allowed his shepherds, when he had his shepherds, allowed his sheep and his cattle to graze only within the land that belonged to him. When he sent them out, if he allowed them to go any farther, he insisted upon muzzling his animals. He would not allow them to graze, in other words, in fields that did not belong to him. Lot had a different attitude. And this is the way the rabbis picture the battle between the shepherds. The shepherds of Abraham, being loyal to Abraham, and having learned something from Abraham, realized that if the land does not belong to me, I have to muzzle my cattle, otherwise they're stealing. And there's an ethical principle involved. The shepherds of Lot had a devious kind of argument. They said, look, Abraham is barren, he has no children. Who is the nearest relative? Who's going to inherit him? Lot. So Lot, in other words, has a right to Abraham's pastures. Now, he said, God had promised Abraham that he would inherit the whole land from the Canaanites and Perizzites. So that basically the land belongs to Abraham. And since Lot is the heir of Abraham, we have the right to take our cattle and eat whatever they want. It belongs to us. Their argument was right up to the crucial point. It is true, both hypotheses, it is true that God had promised Abraham the land. It is true that the nearest relative and hence the heir of Abraham was Lot. But it was not true that they had a right to graze unmuzzled. Why? They were anticipating two future events and trying to act on that legally at the present time, which was unethical. Abraham's shepherds argued what back to this? What was their argument? Their argument was V'haknani v'haprizi oz yoshev v'aretz. To all the arguments about what's going to happen in the future, right now they are the legal owners of the land, and it is criminal and sinful for us to take anything that belongs to them. So the word "us" is beautifully explained. At that time, us, at that time, the Canaanites and Perizzites were dwelling in the land. Hence, the argument of Abraham's people was, right now, it is theirs legally. God promised to us in the future, but right now, the divine law is one of ethics and morals, and you may not invade the property of someone else. A problem, in other words, of Gezeira. Finally, oh, to explain the ethical principle involved. That you cannot act now on the basis of what's going to happen later.
That's only assuming the story, that isn't explicit.
Well, that's the whole point. The point is to explain the explicitness of it. I mean, to explain the presence. I mean, what did the Torah mean? After all, it's a problem. Why didn't the Torah tell you that they had long noses? Or that they were all black-haired?
Well, obviously there's a reason, but...
Well, that's the point.
Why create a story? Just explain it. It should be obvious from this...
But it isn't. But it isn't obvious. You have to explain it. You have no choice here. You see, you're presented with a text which is very economical in its words. Very economical. There are very few words. There is no word that's superfluous. Now, this is a piece of information which seems to be irrelevant. In order to make it relevant, you have to understand it. Now, if you accept the story of Chazal, then read as follows. And there was an argument between the shepherds of Abram and the shepherds of Lot, and the Canaanite and Perizzite were then in the land, which means that the argument was over the right to the land, although the Canaanite and Perizzite were there. You just read a few moments ago that God had promised this land to Abram. It's logical to assume, therefore, the problem was, do any shepherds, does Abraham or his family, which Lot is a part of the family, have a right to the land at the present time? The answer is no.
But the tenor of the whole story would seem to indicate the opposite.
Yes. True. This is not to negate the literal story. On the contrary, that there isn't enough to go around. Therefore,
one has to go.
No, but why can't you take part of the other's land? In other words, to take more land. That's the whole problem. The Canaanite and Perizzite were not in the land. Is that for me? Is an indication of that fact. Now, I just want to make one more comment, because I must leave, as I told you, at 9 sharp. Verse 12 and 13, finally. Abraham did what? Abraham stayed in the land of Canaan, and Lot stayed in the land of the plain, and pitched his tent, in other words, and put his camp until Sodom. Was that good or bad? Was he right or wrong in doing that? The answer is a subtle judgment in the next verse. Torah does not give anything explicit, only implicit. The Anshei Sodom Ra'im V'chata'im L'Hashem Ma'od. The people of Sodom were very wicked. The Torah doesn't tell you anything directly about Lot. It simply says, here was a fellow who, because he couldn't get along in his business with his uncle, decided to go to Sodom. Sodom was a sin city, period. So you have your judgment of Lot given in subtle, indirect terms, without any kind of formal moralizing by the Torah.